From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. U.S., NATO, and Russian diplomats are at a stalemate as 100,000 Russian troops stare down the border at Ukraine. A third round of talks this week between the world powers has made little progress. Russian President Vladimir Putin wants NATO to end its open-door policy, which allows any country to join the Western military alliance, including Ukraine. Jens Stoltenberg is the Secretary General of NATO, and he joins us now. Secretary General, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russia's envoy today said the talks have hit a dead end. The chair of the summit said that the risk of war is the highest it's been in 30 years. How close are we getting to war, Mr. Secretary?
There is a real danger for a renewed armed conflict in Europe because what we have seen is a significant ongoing military buildup by Russia with 100,000 troops, heavy equipment. We have seen the threatening rhetoric from the Russian side. They say that if we don't do exactly as they demand, there will be what they call military technical consequences for us. On top of this, we also have the Russian track record of using military force against neighbors, also against Ukraine. So that just makes it even more important to engage with Russia and to send a clear message that if they use force, there will be severe consequences for them, and that we are ready to sit down and engage in constructive dialogue if they are ready to do so.
So you say a real danger of armed conflict. Now that all three rounds of talks this week have gone down in flames, the U.S. says it is settling on sanctions at this point. What is NATO prepared to do? How do you engage moving forward?
So we are still ready to meet Russia. We had a meeting in the NATO-Russia Council for the first time in more than 2 years. We sat together for more than 4 hours. The discussions were open and frank, difficult, but that's exactly why also the meeting was so important. And we put forward on the table for them a wide range of issues, arms control, measures to increase transparency on military activities, mechanisms to reduce risks for incidents and accidents, and many other issues to help to diffuse the tensions in and around Ukraine and address security concerns in Europe. And we also made it clear that we are ready to put these proposals in written on the table. And they told us yesterday that they were not ready to answer in the meeting, but they will come back to us. And of course, we expect a more formal response from Russia. And in the meantime, we are ready to engage in dialogue, but not to compromise on core principles for European security, including the right for every nation to choose its own path. Mm.
Is Vladimir Putin taking advantage of a moment of weakness here, sir, with Biden and his domestic problems, with the disarray in Europe, fractures and friction in NATO? Do you believe Russia sees an opening to make a move right now?
So what we see is a united NATO. We see a very strong message, and that was one of the advantages with the meeting yesterday, that we had 30 allies, and of course also including the United States, sitting in the same room, conveying exactly the same message, that we are united, that we will not compromise, neither on the right for every nation to choose its own path when it comes to what kind of security arrangements it wants to be part of, including NATO, and not compromise on the right for all allies to defend each other. NATO is based on the core principle that if one ally is attacked, it's regarded as an attack on all allies, one for all for one. And actually, the U.S. is we're very grateful for a very strong commitment of the United States, not only in words, but also in deeds, to coordinate closely with European allies. And there are actually more U.S. military presence in Europe now than a few years ago. So the reality is that we are doing more together, also in response to the aggressive Russian behavior.
Yes, and we'll remind listeners that Russia took Crimea, a small but important portion of Ukraine, through an invasion in 2014. So how are you preparing for the prospect that Russia might annex Ukraine piecemeal?
So first of all, since the illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014, NATO has implemented the biggest reinforcement to our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. For the first time in our history, we have combat-ready troops. Of course, if Russia further invades Ukraine, there will be severe economic sanctions. There will be a high price to pay. Ukrainian forces are supported, trained by many NATO allies. They're much more well-equipped, well-trained now than in 2014. So that will also impose cost on Russia. And then, of course, we're ready to further increase the presence in the eastern part of the alliance if that is needed.
You talk about sanctions, but ultimately, though, are NATO's hands tied if Russia invades soon and Ukraine is not a member of NATO?
There is a difference between being a close partner as Ukraine. We provide them support. We help and train their forces. But of course, Ukraine is not covered by our collective defense clause, which only applies for NATO allies in Europe and, of course, for North America, also U.S. and Canada.
Mr. Secretary General, what would you say to Americans, to Europeans, to anyone who is worried about conflict, even a second Cold War here?
That as long as we stand together, North America and Europe, we represent 50% of the world's military might, 50% of the world's economic might, then we are safe. Then we are able to deter any aggression against any NATO ally. The purpose of NATO is not to provoke a conflict, but it is to prevent the conflict, to deter any aggressor. And again, standing united, investing in our shared security, as we do and have done for many years, is the best way to preserve peace for NATO allies.
Secretary General of NATO Jens Stoltenberg. Secretary General, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The demand for at-home COVID tests has surged along with the Omicron variant. And this week, the Biden administration will require health insurers to reimburse people for at-home tests. But it's not always clear which test you should get. Matt Herper is here to help. He's with our partners at Stat News. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, Matt. So you spoke with Boston-based pediatrician Mariana Parker about all of this. Right before Christmas, she used 5 COVID rapid tests and 3 PCR tests. They were all negative for her, but her husband eventually tested positive. Tell us about her experience.
Dr. Parker is really emblematic of a lot of people that we talk to in reporting this, where a lot of people are fairly convinced that they've been exposed and are not testing positive on the rapid test in their experience. Now, some of those people may have a cold or something, but there's kind of this worry out there that are these catching this? And there was a study that came out last week that was worrisome for some of the uses people are using rapid tests for. We don't, most of us, have access to antigen tests that we can take every day. And we certainly don't have access to PCRs that we can take every day.
You mentioned this study. Earlier this month, a small 30-patient study raised doubts about how much at-home rapid antigen tests can actually detect the Omicron variant in the early days of infection. What exactly did researchers uncover?
So in that study, they happened to have this group of 30 patients who were getting both the really sensitive PCR test and the antigen tests every day. And what they found was there was a really consistent in that group lag between the PCR and the rapid test, and that they actually had 4 cases of transmission out of those 30 people that they were able to find. So that raised a lot of concerns. Now, certainly if you're going to get a test because you're feeling sick, you know, if that test tells you that you have COVID, these tests work very well for that. But the question is, in some of these other uses, some researchers are wondering if that's different for this new variant, if we need to be a little more careful and if they're not as much of a layer of safety as some people hoped.
I also want to go back to some of the basics here. One of the researchers you spoke to pointed out that rapid antigen tests are not tests of infectiousness. Can you explain that? Can you remind us the difference between an antigen test and a PCR test?
Sure. An antigen test looks for the proteins that coat the virus, and they're somewhat different proteins for each of the antigen tests. PCR takes a sample and makes lots and lots of copies of genetic material, either RNA or DNA, that's in the sample. And so if there is RNA from this virus, this is an RNA virus, you find it even if it's at a pretty low level. And so PCR is a very sensitive test, and you can really trust the results. The antigen tests are by design less sensitive. In fact, the head of the device division at the FDA said these are not tests of infectiousness, that that is not how the FDA views them.
Okay, Matt, bottom line, if it's true that at-home rapid tests are less accurate in the early days of infection, should we still be using them?
Yes, because when they detect a positive, that's a positive. And if you get a negative result, it doesn't mean you don't have COVID. That's the big message here, is that the tests are useful, they're important. We don't want to go back to only having PCR, but maybe sometimes we're asking a little too much of them.
That's Matt Herper with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've heard a lot of numbers during this pandemic, but let's take a moment to pause and think about one in particular, 167,000. That's how many kids in the U.S. have lost at least one parent or primary caregiver to COVID-19. In a moment, we'll hear from one family who stepped up to care for their orphaned cousins last year. But first, let's bring in Charles Nelson. He's a professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at Harvard University. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
The losses for these children in this country and around the world are so profound that you're among those who have coined the term COVID orphans, and you've said it's like a hidden cost of this pandemic. No one's really talking about it. Tell us more.
So I think front and center, of course, our concerns have been with people who are getting ill or who are dying, but it turns out that one in four deaths of adults is accompanied by a child who's then been orphaned or left without a parent or grandparent caregiver.
And we're reading that grieving kids can face some pretty serious risks, starting with so many psychological issues. Can you tell us about some of those issues that you're seeing for kids whose parents have died of COVID-19?
One concern, of course, is that grief manifests itself differently in young children than it does in adults. Certainly kids will be experiencing anxiety, and if they're old enough, probably depression. But then there are secondary and tertiary effects. So some children might act out, and teachers might see that in the classroom. Then there can be the casualty of the loss of health insurance or food scarcity, which then leads to increased stress in kids. And that stress can take both the psychological and a biological toll on children. So I think we need to think about this as sort of a cascade of the many things that can really conspire to pull the rug out from underneath these kids.
You've used the term biologically embedded. Those are some of the physical consequences. Can you say more about that?
Sure. So if we think of stress, for example, we all know what stress feels like psychologically, but biologically, what happens is that the brain starts to produce various stress hormones, and these hormones, if they're chronically elevated, can actually do harm to the brain. In addition, they can do harm to the body, and they can elevate the risk of physical illnesses as well as psychological ailments. If children are grieving the loss of their parents, and if that grief is not recognized and it's not treated, short-term effects can become long-term effects.
Of course, when parents die, there are also some more immediate concerns, like who is going to raise and care for the child. Can you talk about what children need from adults immediately after this kind of tragedy?
Sure. They're going to need lots of support and a feeling of safety. These children are going to feel as though the world has been turned upside down. They need an adult who's there for them all the time. Ideally would be a family member, but teachers will play a role, clergy can play a role, neighbors can play a role, relatives can play a role. What we need is a safety net that gets put into place immediately so that that child is really being protected by adults. And that needs to continue until the child seems to have gotten on the other side and started to resolve this grief.
You've been critical of government, saying that local, state, and federal officials have been silent on this issue of COVID orphans. What should they be doing when we're thinking in the context of what you say is a safety net?
Sure. So I don't really fault municipalities and governments as much as wanting them to pay attention to this problem. The first step is for them to recognize that this is an issue that they have to pay attention to. Then it's a matter of who should be responsible. Someone needs to step up. Is it a child protection authority, for example? Is it neighborhood associations? I mean, so if the child needs counseling, for example, or possibly even medication, are there people there that the child can see quickly and not have to wait 2 months to get help?
You know, you touched on this when I asked you what adults can do, but what can a child's community, friends, extended family do to help a child who is going through this kind of loss?
So I think they need to basically be there to hold that child's hand. They need to reassure that child that things will get better. They need to make sure that material supports are there, like, again, food and shelter and things like that. And they basically need to be available 24/7. Anytime that child cries out for help or shows any sign of needing help, the adult needs to be available. Because if too much time goes by and the child's needs are not attended to, that feeling of abandonment is just going to get overwhelming for that child. We need to put in place a whole series of things just in case one line of defense doesn't work, that there's a backup. It could be teachers. It could be the parents of friends. It could be the school social worker or school psychologist. But I think we need to set up a whole community of care providers for the child.
That's Dr. Charles Nelson, professor of pediatrics at Harvard University. Doctor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Let's turn now to Cornelius and Melanie Daniel, a Georgia family already the parents of three young children when they adopted their two teenaged cousins last summer. This after the teens' parents died of COVID-19 within 24 hours of each other back in July. I spoke with them by Zoom and asked Cornelius to tell us about his uncle, Martin Daniel, who was 53 years old when he died, and his aunt Trina, only 49.
So my uncle was a very inquisitive guy. Very witty fellow. He and I both, and Melanie, all graduated from Tuskegee. He inspired us all. He was a chemist, which kind of inspired my love for science. And so when he would come home, we would do experiments. And he's a great guy. Great guy.
A role model.
Absolutely.
We know that your Uncle Martin and wife Trina both died of COVID-19, and also that their children, now your children, 18-year-old Miles and 15-year-old Marina, got COVID as well. Can you share with us what happened?
So we were all together in May for Miles' graduation. So Miles graduated from high school in May. And so I got a call on July 6th from my wife, Melanie, saying, hey, my Uncle Martin had passed away. I said, what happened? And she said, I think it's COVID. My dad had received a call from my Aunt Trina. She had left him a voicemail, and you could tell in the voicemail that she had labored breathing and, you know, she wasn't doing very well herself. Mm. But my uncle was already deceased at the house.
Oh, wow.
And then shortly after that, my aunt was taken to the hospital where she collapsed. They resuscitated her once, and then she collapsed again, and they could not resuscitate her. Okay. And so after that, Miles and Marina was both also COVID positive, and they were under quarantine in the home where they found their father and their mother sick. Miles turned 18 the Sunday after his parents passed away. And so it's been a long journey. Recently, they lost their grandmother as well. Mm. Within the same week of losing their grandmother, they had to celebrate their mother's birthday. But with God's grace and a lot of family support, we've been able to sustain ourselves.
Melanie, I want to talk to you. I want to bring you in here. This is something that so many families are going through right now, losing both, and all of those milestones that we take for granted, like turning 18 and graduating from high school. How are you trying to ease that grief and help these teenagers deal with that trauma?
To be completely honest, we take it one day at a time. I've even said to Marina, some days when we can't take it a day at a time, we take an hour at a time, and ensuring that there's positive reinforcement throughout the days, the months, and hopefully the years to come.
How are you two doing it? You're trying to make things as normal as possible for these children, but you're also grieving.
We put ourselves on the back burner. For one, we're not the only family experiencing this. This is bigger than us, and God has given us a bigger purpose. We stepped into that moment and walked into it with that focus, making sure these young people have the opportunities they need to move forward in life. Then we have done our jobs.
We just spoke
to a psychiatrist and researcher, he was thinking a lot about whether the government has done enough to help families like yours. And you told us that you recently wrote to your senators, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. What did you tell them?
I asked about legislation to provide provisions for families who have taken in COVID survivors and the children of COVID victims. I asked about educational benefits. More importantly, I asked about mental health and healthcare benefits for these families. You know, these families have now had to adjust. It hadn't been easy.
Yeah.
I'll be completely honest with you. And with the resources we have, we've extended open arms to our cousins. A lot of folks don't really have a lot of those resources. My concern is that so many of these young folks, the worst place to leave them is in a dark hole where they can't have the opportunity to talk to grief counselors, to talk to mental health professionals, and to not have so many loopholes and red tape to provide those services. A lot of that we've had to fund on our own.
Have you heard from them yet?
I have not. I was told to give it about 5 days or so, and then we'll follow up.
Melanie, we know that your Uncle Martin and his wife, Trina, were not yet vaccinated. One of the more heartbreaking parts of this story as well is that they were hesitant, but they had finally scheduled their first doses when they got COVID-19. Does that frustrate you or perhaps make you a stronger advocate for vaccines?
Doesn't really frustrate me simply because I know that everything happens for a reason. I have a strong spiritual belief, but it does make me a stronger advocate for being vaccinated because without putting in the works, then our faith means nothing. So we have to make sure that we at least take the precautions that are out there to protect ourselves.
Well, Cornelius and Melanie, I thank you both for speaking to us, for sharing your story. Our deepest condolences to you and your family, and we wish you the best.
Thank you so much, Tanya, for the opportunity to share our story.
Thank you.
President Biden's pick for vice chair of the Federal Reserve spoke before the Senate Banking Committee at her confirmation hearing today. In her opening statement, Lael Brainard pointed to the strong economic recovery over the past year, then brought up the issue of rising costs.
But inflation is too high, and working people around the country are concerned about how far their paychecks will go.
Let's bring in NPR's Scott Horsley, who's been watching the hearing. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you. The issue front and center at the hearing is, of course, inflation. What stood out to you in the hearing today?
You know, just as Fed Chairman Jerome Powell did at his own hearing earlier this week, Brainard stressed the central bank is focused on inflation and that it's ready to crack down. For most of the last 2 years, the Fed's been primarily concerned with propping up the economy and getting people back to work, which is one of its two main goals. But the other goal is stable prices. And right now, that has moved to be very much the front burner issue for the Fed, not surprisingly. Of course, this week we got the inflation report for December, which showed consumer prices climbing at the fastest pace in almost 40 years. And it's no longer just a few, you know, pandemic-sensitive items where the prices are going up. Inflation was north of 3% in more than two out of three spending categories that the government keeps track of.
I want to play this exchange with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Here it is.
What if inflation is caused by kinks in the supply chain? Prices jump because the supply chain is just not functioning. Does the Fed have a tool to deal with that?
No, we have a tool that operates on the demand side, which is the federal funds rate.
So how much are supply chain issues contributing to rising prices, and can the Fed do anything to address them?
Yeah, it's certainly part of the problem. And no, the Fed doesn't really have tools to deal with that, as Brainard said. A good example here is the rising price of new and used cars, which has been one of the big drivers of inflation over the last year. That's mainly the result of that computer chip shortage, which has limited car makers' ability to produce as many cars and trucks as consumers would like. The Fed can't churn out more computer chips. It can't fix that supply problem. Mm. What it can do is tamp down on demand by raising interest rates. And Brainerd and her colleagues are prepared to do that. They're hoping, though, they won't have to clamp down on demand too much. They are assuming that there will be some improvement in the tangled supply chains at some point over the course of the year. And Senator Warren said she hopes the Fed won't overreact here, because if the Fed hits the brakes too hard, that could stall the economic recovery.
So you talk about, Brainerd mentioned interest rates. Is that the only tool the Fed can use to get inflation under control at this point?
That's the main tool. There are other steps the Fed can take. It's pumped a lot of money into the economy since the pandemic began, and it can gradually pull some of that money out, which is another way to tamp down on demand. But raising interest rates is the Fed's primary inflation-fighting weapon. When Fed officials met back in December, most said they expected to raise interest rates at least three times this year, each time by a quarter percentage point. Some policymakers are now saying we could see four rate hikes this year. And forecasters think those rate hikes are likely to begin sooner than had been expected, maybe as early as March.
Really quickly, does Lael Brainerd have a clear path to confirmation?
I think so. She did get some pointed questions from Republicans on the committee today, particularly in the area of climate change, which some GOP lawmakers think is none of the Fed's business. She offered reassurance that the Fed's not going to be telling banks they can't lend money to fossil fuel companies. And I think she'll get at least a measure of bipartisan support.
NPR's Scott Horsley. As always, Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
As we've been reporting, many hospitals throughout the country are stretched to capacity, dealing with the highest number of COVID patients reported during the pandemic. President Biden announced this morning that he's sending military medical personnel to help hospitals in six states.
Today, I'm announcing our next deployment of six additional federal medical teams, a total of more than 120 military medical personnel, to six hard-hit states: Michigan, New York, New Jersey, Ohio, Rhode Island.
The other state is New Mexico. In recent days, ERs in Boston have also seen a 50% increase in hospitalizations. Dr. Christian Arbelez is chief of emergency medicine at Boston Medical Center and joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Arbelez, can you describe what you're seeing right now in your emergency room at Boston Medical Center?
Sure. Yeah, you know, here at Boston Medical Center, we are facing significant challenges due to the Omicron and this new surge, along with the high volume, particularly in the emergency department. You know, we're seeing up to 450, 480 daily visits in our emergency department, and our particular patient population is one that we serve here in the Boston area with complex needs, vulnerable patient population. And I want to just highlight, on top of all of this, that we've been facing a pretty significant behavioral health pandemic, right? And so on top of that, this Omicron surge has been incredibly challenging.
Let's break this down for a minute. Upwards of 500 patients a day. What kinds of patients are coming into the ER with COVID? Are they young, old, vaccinated, unvaccinated?
You know, we're seeing all of it. We're seeing all of that, vaccinated, unvaccinated, sick, not sick, asymptomatic. Some of our homeless patients are coming in from shelters with asymptomatic COVID. We really are seeing everything from across the board. And I think what makes this very different than the prior surges are that, you know, we have patients that are still coming in for regular emergency care. That's probably one of the most significant differences from the first surge, where we saw a really significant volume drop in our RADs across the country.
How are you treating these patients, and are there better outcomes now than in those early days of the pandemic?
Yeah, the science has really moved in advance for us. Now we have, you know, medication and treatments that we're able to provide, monoclonal antibody infusions, and just a better understanding of the virus and the way that it affects our patient population. I think the difference for us this surge is that we're seeing, you know, those that are unvaccinated, I think, are the ones that are most affected and ending up sick and in our ICUs, and then the young as well.
You know, when we have these conversations, immediately we're thinking about the doctors and nurses and medical staff. What sorts of stress is this surge putting on your staff? We've heard about shortages at hospitals. What's the situation there?
You know, that's probably the hardest one for me as a chief of emergency services here. You know, our staff has, this has just been like tidal wave after tidal wave. Now we're on the fourth surge. The way that this spread through our community and particularly through our staff and, you know, all the way to our families, right? Like heading into the Christmas holidays, you know, many of us were facing isolation because it had come into our circles and bubbles. The staff has, you know, been really stretched, working extra hours to help pitch in for their colleagues who have been out. Luckily here, it's just a wonderful team. I'm truly inspired here by our emergency providers, nursing, all of our colleagues who just have stepped up in such an incredible way. I think, you know, it just makes us a stronger team.
You know, I'm also wondering about other parts of the hospital that might be impacted by this. Early in the pandemic, we saw that many people who needed to have elective surgeries or even major surgeries had to postpone those. What is that situation like?
Yeah, you know, as a hospital, we have been preparing for this moment that we're currently in as if November. We've been really trying to prepare for our staffing, our surge spaces, our capacity, and really beginning to be thoughtful and deliberate about how we ramp down our operations in a way that was considerate of our patients. We wanted to make sure that we were postponing non-essential surgeries, didn't want to delay anyone's care, making sure that we move people from the emergency department to other alternative sites, such as ambulatory clinics, telehealth visits. And so we've just been really creative and nimble, trying to figure out how do we build capacity outside of the walls of the emergency department so that we can continue providing care and just get through this wave successfully and then always with our patients' best interests in mind.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Christian Arbelez is Chief of Emergency Medicine at Boston Medical Center. Elsewhere in the show, we heard how a small rural hospital in Oconto, Wisconsin, is also coping with the latest COVID surge. You can find that conversation and all of our coverage at hereandnow.org.
The COVID surge has been hard on schools, too, of course. We've reported about it on our program, but you can also talk with any parent or teacher about the days since winter break ended. Many teachers are sick or in quarantine, and schools are scrambling to find substitute teachers. Claire McInerney of member station KUT reports that schools in Texas are getting creative.
What's up, Leo?
What's up?
How you doing? Hey, Margaret. Let me get the door for you, dude.
Every morning during drop-off at the Austin Jewish Academy, Principal Chris Aguero and other staff members go through the same routine. Take a student's temperature, hand them a mask, and ask how they're feeling.
In the K through 5, at least, kids are just brutally honest. So how are you feeling today? Not great. Any, you know, cough or sore throat? I got both.
But this screening process is no match for the latest surge of COVID-19 cases in Texas. With many teachers out sick or quarantining, it's up to office manager Karen Tarantolo to find a substitute.
Last year, we had kind of a group of regular subs, you know, former teachers, retired teachers, things like that, that we could draw on. But since COVID has really ramped up, those people have just kind of gone away.
So Tarantolo has turned to the students' parents to see if they can help out.
For, you know, an hour, half day, whole day, you know, whatever they can do, we're happy to have their help.
This isn't a problem isolated at this small private school in Austin. The nearby Hayes Consolidated School District is also asking parents to be substitutes. In other places across the country, districts are lowering the requirements for substitute teachers, waiving application fees, and increasing pay. Austin ISD, the biggest public school system in the area, had 100 more sub requests last week compared to the same week last year. This high demand prompted the superintendent to go fill in at a high school math class. But mostly, says Francisca Schindler, an elementary art teacher, teachers are carrying the burden.
Say that there's three classes in the fourth grade and one teacher doesn't show up. So those students are divided amongst the other two classes. So now they have a class and a half.
She said that's tricky at her campus because a lot of the students are in language programs that don't mix and match. This latest surge has a lot of people asking, why don't schools go back to virtual learning? But in many cases, they don't really have a choice. The state of Texas won't fund schools unless they provide an in-person option. At the Austin Jewish Academy, Principal Aguero says in-person school is crucial to help kids keep a routine and provide normalcy. So he's thankful for the parents helping out.
It's exhausting. It's physically exhausting.
Maricela Maddox is one of the parents subbing. She's a trained attorney, has never been a teacher, but she's been filling in all school year.
There's always been lesson plans, even when the teachers are out unexpectedly, or the other teachers will help me figure out something that does keep the students engaged so we don't have to do the movie thing.
She said she's happy to provide consistency to the students when so much is changing. For NPR News, I'm Claire McInerney in Austin.
A new federal lawsuit alleges that 16 private universities, including Yale, Georgetown, Columbia, and Northwestern, have engaged in price fixing, working together to limit how much financial aid they offer to admitted students. It's the latest in a string of lawsuits over college admissions practices in recent years. Wall Street Journal reporter Melissa Korn has been covering this story, and she joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So break this down for us. What is this lawsuit accusing these schools of doing?
Sure. So this lawsuit is saying that these universities, and there's some big name schools here for sure, that they shouldn't be allowed to cooperate on setting financial aid calculations because they aren't entirely need blind. There is a carve out from antitrust law that would allow schools to cooperate on determining, you know, how much to look at assets and income when they're looking to figure out how much to give in financial aid. But schools can only do it if they are need blind in admissions. And this lawsuit is alleging that these schools are not actually need blind, even though they say they are.
Okay, let me see if I understand this, because it is legal for colleges to communicate with each other about the formulas they use to calculate an applicant's financial needs, as long as they don't consider an applicant's ability to pay tuition when they decide whether to admit them or not. So how much do these schools collaborate and share information?
Quite a bit. So a few decades ago, there were a handful of them, the Ivies plus MIT, actually would meet up to discuss individual applicants. And if more than one of the schools was admitting them, they would hash out a plan for how much aid to give, you know, for each individual student. That's not allowed anymore. But these schools that are being sued, along with some others, meet regularly, a couple times a year, to go over the formulas that they're going to use for the aid calculations. So they don't discuss individuals, but they do determine kind of as a group what the standards should be in terms of how they determine aid.
Who brought this lawsuit, and what evidence do they have that schools are colluding?
The lawsuit was brought by five graduates of various schools that are named in the suit, and they, you know, in the complaint, which is a fascinating read at about 60 pages, they cite statements from the schools themselves. So notes that the school looks at financial need when they're admitting students off of a wait list, or that they do give an edge to the children of donors, and those are indications that they are not need blind.
Mm. There is a history of this. In 1991, eight Ivy League schools and MIT were charged with price fixing. Remind us what happened there.
Yeah, so those were the instances in which the schools would talk about individual applicants and come up with an aid offer. The aim, the school said, was to allow schools to compete on fit rather than price, so students could just find the best school for them, not just the cheapest school. So the Ivies signed a consent decree, MIT had a separate settlement, and a few years later, legislation was introduced that laid out exactly when schools could or couldn't collaborate on their aid offers. And from that grew this group of college presidents that meets a couple times a year to hash out the aid calculations.
For this latest case, what's been the response from the colleges?
So a number of schools have said that they don't comment on pending litigation or didn't respond to my requests for comment earlier in the week. Yale, Caltech, and Brown said, you know, that they have confidence in their aid practices. Brown said the complaint was without merit. This is not something that the schools will just sit by and watch happen.
The backdrop of all of this is there have been a number of other scandals and lawsuits over college admissions in recent years. The Varsity Blues college admissions bribery and cheating investigation, cases over affirmative action, a case alleging Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants. Is this all part of a bigger effort to make college admissions more fair, more transparent when you think about this latest case?
Yeah, it's not a concerted joint effort by a particular group that's behind all of this, but there is this groundswell of, you know, concern that the status quo of selective college admissions just isn't working anymore. It isn't fair. It puts certain students of certain backgrounds at a disadvantage, and it's time to shake things up. So whether it's by looking at students' financial need, their racial and ethnic backgrounds, a whole bunch of factors here, whether it's through litigation or other means, people are trying to make a change.
That's Melissa Korn. She covers higher education for the Wall Street Journal. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And moms, we need your help for an upcoming story. How has your career and your sense of economic security been impacted by the pandemic? How have you been juggling the more complicated demands of work and home life? Tell us at hereandnow.org or email us at letters@hereandnow.org. And thanks. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now.